Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd, with me, Barbara Drew. Today, I'm sitting down with our wine director, Mark Pardo, MW, to discuss hot vintages, their effect on wine production, and what this all means for the cellars of the future. Mark, welcome.
Thank you, Barbara.
Mark, it's not your first time on the podcast. Welcome back.
Thank you.
For our listeners who have not yet listened to season one and two, shame on you, but can you please give them a very brief potted history of your career in the wine trade to date?
How long have you got? It's a very long wine career. I come from a family who worked in hospitality. So my mother and father opened a pub to serve good beer and a good sandwich in the late 50s. And they ran that for 15 years until 1974, when they opened one of the first small country house hotels in the country as well. And so I grew up around hospitality and thought for a long time that would be my career. But working for my family, I realized that the hours were insupportable and therefore looked for a career that was parallel. And I lighted on wine more by luck than judgment and started my career just working as an office clerk for a company called Hallgarten Wines, in those days in North London. Moved to Grant's St. James's, which no longer exists. And then from there, I worked for a very small wine importer in Surrey, who had amongst them a client who had started a small business from his garage. He was looking for a partner. And I thought, this is an opportunity. And so I took a half share in his business, and we grew that from nothing, really, to like a little mini Berry Brothers. We did all en primeur, we did retail, we did some specific wholesale in London, we did entertainment, we did dinners, we had producers coming over to come and talk to us in our little converted cowshed. And I'd always known members of Berry Brothers, and I'd worked with one of them on Master of Wine Business. And one day over lunch, an idea kind of floated, and it thought it would be a good idea if I joined Berries. So they found a way to incorporate me into Berries, where I've done also a range of jobs. I started as commercial director. I've also been the vine director. And now I'm the wine director, which means I just get to do all the nice bits.
And as you say, quite a long career. We were discussing before we started recording that you have now bought 40 vintages. Is that right?
The very first wines I bought were 1982 Bataille and Eau Bataille.
So you really are a wonderful person to talk to for perspective on how the wine trade and wine styles have evolved in that time. Tell us, what is the biggest change that you've seen in those 40 years in terms of wine and winemaking itself?
I think the simplest way to summarise it is that back in the 70s and 80s, and even to an extent the 1990s, really good vintages or great vintages were relatively infrequent. You'd get two, three, maybe if you're really lucky, four in a decade. And those vintages were defined by the simple fact that all the fruit got ripe. The skill of the winemaker and the chateau in those days was very much to find a way to get around the problems that nature had thrown at it. From the 2000s onwards, we've seen an increasing number of much warmer vintages. And that means that the fruit does get ripe pretty much every year. And even in what have been called lighter vintages like 2021, which was quite a wet, long vintage, against the context of vintages of the 1970s, that's still a very ripe vintage. And some lovely wines have been made in that vintage, albeit in a different style to what comes out of the classic regions nowadays, because they are just so much warmer. I think when you and I were studying, Barbara, we would have been told that the great wine regions of the world are those where the climate is marginal.
Yes, absolutely.
You could not guarantee the fruit would get ripe every year. And it was actually this kind of jeopardy of the end of season, of waiting for the fruit to finally crawl up to the line and get full ripeness. It was that contributed complexity to the wines. We don't have those features anymore. In the old days, the skill of the vigneron was knowing how long to keep rolling the dice and how long to wait until they could harvest the fruit to maximize maturity. Nowadays, the skill is knowing when to harvest as quickly as possible to hit the perfect date when you have the right balance, as right as you can get, on sugar levels, acidity and phenolic ripeness. So the dynamic has changed completely.
I find this absolutely fascinating because it seems to me that this being the case, we almost need to rethink everything we thought we knew about wine. We need to reconsider what a good vintage is, what a bad vintage is. We need to reconsider where you can grow grapes and even rethink what the style of these classic wines should be, whether it's Bordeaux or Burgundy. So I'll be really interested to get your thoughts on this over the course of our discussion.
Well, I hope that you've remembered all those points, Barbara, because there's about 10 questions in there and all of them are relevant, and we'll try and unpick them bit by bit. The first point you made, for a long time, I've been of the opinion that we mislead ourselves when we talk about grape vintages, because the grape vintage is synonymous with the vintages that I was talking about of the past, when if you have a very ripe year, that gives you wines that are much better than normal, and therefore that becomes a great vintage in comparison to all the other vintages where you didn't get that level of ripeness. We do now, as I've already said, get that level of ripeness pretty much every year. So that distinction of why a vintage is great or not has actually changed. I'm more of the opinion that we should talk about exceptional vintages, not least because I quite like the double meaning of the word exceptional, but every vintage now, certainly from reputable producers, is at minimum good, almost always very good. And to therefore disenfranchise our expectation of the quality of those, in inverted commas, lesser vintages by simply concentrating on the great vintages, we're missing a trick. So now in the palette of descriptors available to us, everything is good. And then the really call it fine rather than great, they are exceptional because they stand outside the norm. I don't necessarily mean to say by that, therefore, that they are better, but they are different because of the character that exceptional conditions have created. I don't think there's such a dichotomy between poor vintages and successful vintages, which then become great vintages. Everything now pretty much starts from a bottom line as being at minimum good.
I like that. There's a phrase you occasionally come across in the wine trade that due to our greater understanding in the vineyard and due to better technology in the winery, that if you're making bad wine these days, it's because you're really trying to. Would you agree with that?
If you make bad wine, you're trying to make bad wine. Well, anybody who's worth their salt, of course, doesn't try to make bad wine. But the level of understanding that is available now to a vigneron and a winemaker is so much more detailed than it ever used to be. If you willfully choose to ignore that advice and go down your own route, you will learn by trial and error, and you may make some missteps along the way. But now I think there is such, I'm going to use the word control, but I use it advisedly because I don't want to make it sound soulless and manipulative. But if you do your job now, mistakes are very, very rare indeed. And I think within that statement, there is still plenty of room for individuality and flexibility of approach, because you're still able to make those decisions that will take your wine down in one direction or another based on some pretty solid information. So there is subjectivity available to the wine producer, and individuality is always created, but within a structure of confidence of making the right decisions.
So if we start from a baseline of every wine, every vintage is at least good. What is it that sets these exceptional vintages apart? You made a point of saying it's not simply great wines. It could be vintages with very specific character. Will we get to a point where it's actually the cooler vintages? Those are the ones which are truly exceptional.
Yeah. Well, by that, my own definition, the cooler vintages would become exceptional because they are outside what has become the norm. What defines a truly exceptional warm vintage is the arrival of all the key trigger points in a vintage at the right time and the right moment. And it will also be years where extremes have been avoided. For a long time, we talked about global warming. Now, the phrase is climate change. Yes, we do experience global warming, and all the vineyards, the classic vineyards around the world, are harvesting their fruit 1, 2, or even 3 weeks earlier than they used to. The high level of warmth has definitely contributed to a change in that front. But the other challenges that have arisen from climate change is, for example, early bud burst, meaning greater exposure to spring frosts, which happens much more regularly now than it used to. It used to be a once in a twice a generation event, and now it happens seemingly every 3 or 4 years that one region or another gets hit by a pretty heavy frost. Extremes of heat. So high heat is not the enemy of the wine. It's really intense high heat.
Yeah.
And we make comparisons between 22 vintage, which is where we've been concentrating on most this year in terms of our releases. And I've just come back from Burgundy, for example. If we compare 22 to 2020, which was the last really hot vintage, 2020 had periods of 3 or 4 days when the temperature was way above 40 degrees, 45 degrees.
And this is in Bordeaux
and Burgundy. Yeah. And everywhere in that band through Europe. Whereas in 22, yes, it was hot. It was 35, 36, 37 degrees. That's a pretty hot holiday, and you'd probably stay inside most of the time. But the vine can cope with that, as long as certain other criteria are preserved. Another real challenge are these freak, very, very heavy storms that seem to arrive. So in 22, a very small portion of Givry-Chambertin got decimated. I mean, torrential amount of rain fell and almost washed vines out of the ground. There was so much rain falling. And suddenly down in Châteauneuf-du-Pape, a tornado ripped through the Crow area of the vineyard, and Vieux Telegraph has no wine at all.
Wow.
The other side, people made wine, but just straight down the middle of the Crow and wiped out Vieux Telegraph. So we have these real extremes of weather. And I remember Eva Fricker in Germany saying, whatever weather we get now, it's an extreme.
Hmm.
And even if it's windy, it's much, much windier. Hmm. Heat, per se, is not the issue. It's all the bits that go around it. And heat is manageable as long as you have access to enough water and the rain comes at the right time.
And in your experience of talking to producers, are there any regions which are managing to escape this, or no matter where you're based, are producers seeing this increase in extreme weather events? Yeah.
Some regions just have no choice. They are where they are. And they have a reputation based on the wines that come from that region. There's absolutely a move to plant higher than we used to, or look for climates that are more moderated. So wines from islands, for example, tend to somehow manage better because of the much more maritime influence of the weather. But even within classic regions, there are opportunities for areas that were probably not so well regarded previously, which are now of increasing interest. If you take Burgundy, for example, there's a whole clutch of villages that most people might have heard of, but don't really have much of a reputation for making, say, some of the top wines of the region, like Santenay, like Marange, like Massenet, Saint-Romain, etc., etc., or even the more generic vineyards of up on top of the Côte, in the Haute Côte. Now, these areas all have fantastic Burgundian terroir. The reason that they didn't have the reputation in the past is because it was too risky for the vigneron to invest all their time and effort in trying to create the best fruit they could from those vineyards, because they were very likely to not get ripe.
Yeah.
But now they do get ripe.
Yeah.
If you add to that the global demand for Burgundy, it's also worth the while of that wine producer to maximize the potential of these outlying vineyards. And the quality from the kind of villages I've just talked about has absolutely rocketed in the last decade or so. And so that's an example of a region that has other options. But of course, you have the traditional famous terroirs that still have to cope with these new challenges. And I remember Frédéric Meunier saying to me once that for him, the definition of great terroir is a piece of land that copes with extremes at either end of the scale. So it knows how to cope with extreme heat, but it also knows how to keep with extreme rainfall. Normally, the great terroirs don't get too affected by frost. There are exceptions, of course, but great terroirs have the ability to adapt to those challenges. And then the skill is choosing, as I said earlier on, the right harvest date. Do it in a much more intuitive way. And something Ben LaRue said to me last year, he said, Burgundy is really creating a new style of wine. You can't make old-fashioned Burgundy in modern Burgundy, but the style of these wines is just as compelling. It's just they express themselves in a different way.
This I find absolutely fascinating. I love Burgundian wines, but this sense that in some ways it's almost a new region, or certainly producing new styles of wine, which are simply very, very different to what was produced 40 years ago. Objectively, they are better wines, but they are different.
Well, they're only relatively different. What they are is representative of a style of vintage that never used to happen very often. Now they happen all the time. And of course, allied with that is much greater capability in the vineyard and the cellar. The famous really hot vintage that took everyone by surprise was 2003. And everyone tried to make wine like they were making 1998. You know, it was a hottish year, but no one changed their extractions. They picked at the same time. And a lot of pretty heavy, brutal wines were made. Some of which, I have to say, have stood up all right, but they've never been a particularly attractive vintage in terms of the richness of body, but also because they were so kind of antithetical. They were just not what you expected to come out of those regions. But now we have much more extreme conditions than 2003 happening now on a much more regular basis, and people have adapted their techniques to cope. And as you and I will both agree, Barbara, the fundamental defining issue of what makes a wine interesting is its freshness.
Yes.
I mean, you can build as many flavour complexes into it as you want. If it doesn't leave the palate energised by that experience, then you've lost everything. And nowadays, the ability to retain freshness in the wine is so much more accomplished.
When you're learning about wine, you're taught that riper grapes gives you riper flavours, it gives you more alcohol, more body, but also lower acidity. And the acidity, the freshness, as well as really bringing the wine to life, is one of the key aspects of preserving that wine as it ages and evolves slowly in your cellar. What's your experience of how wines from hotter vintages age?
Well, we don't have really a lot of experience on it because these are relatively recent phenomena. But I do have the opportunity to taste vintages of, say, 10, 15 years old. In fact, only on Friday, I was subjected to a range of first growths over dinner from 12, 8, 10 and 5.
Oh, how miserable.
What a rotten. I had to work on a Friday evening then to benefit from it. And to a wine, they were all magnificent. None of them showing any sense of tiredness or heaviness. What they were just exemplified, certainly the really hotter vintages like 10 and 5, were exemplified by an intensity of flavour. And because the big preservative in red wines is tannin, and hot vintages don't give you less tannin, they just give you a different style of tannin. And it sounds an unlikely thing to talk about is that the tannins ripen, but they do. They become less bitter with longer exposure to sunshine. And these vintages give you riper tannins. So the wines are still absolutely built for the long term, but you don't get that bitter greenness that you can find when tannins aren't properly ripe. And all of them showed admirable freshness, not in a mouth-watering sense, but in the sense that it pulls all the threads of the wine together to hold it in balance in the middle of the palate.
And balance is absolutely key, whether it's warm vintage, whether your wine is 15% alcohol, whether it's 12% alcohol, ensuring that everything in that wine works together. Nothing is too sort of loud or quiet in the orchestra of that bottle.
Yes, so, yes. I think a lot of people get concerned about higher alcohols, and I think, you know, with good reason, it's quite understandable. But full-flavoured And intense wines can accommodate higher alcohol without too much trouble. I've lost count of the number of times when I've been shown a sample, you taste it, and the winemaker looks at you and says, what's the alcohol in that wine? And you say, well, you don't feel it. He said, no, it's 15%. Whether you or not you like wines at 15%, that becomes a subjective choice. But in terms of how the wine is constructed and how it's balanced, you just don't feel it. Because in a sense, all the other elements, the volume levels have been turned up slightly. And so everything kind of moves up the scale together. And I suspect that is part of the trajectory of the maturation curve for these wines of long vintages. Previously, the curve would have been waiting for things to moderate, waiting for tannins to soften, waiting for acidity to calm down a little bit until the wine reached its kind of lighter balance further down the line. I think the sense of finding the sweet spot in that wine is probably in a different part on the curve, probably closer to the front than the tail than it used to be.
One of the things that I always remark on in my tastings is there is this idea that Bordeaux is a wine that needs to be aged. And I think that idea came about because 30, 40, 50 years ago, Bordeaux did need to be aged. Mm. The tannins, as you say, they weren't particularly ripe. There was a bitterness, greenness, often a hardness to those wines. And they needed 10, 15, 20 years in the cellar before they really became approachable and enjoyable.
I see that effect in other regions too. When I have my time in Barolo and Barbaresco, the wines used to be made the way they did because of the fearsome attack of the tannin of Nebbiolo. Now you just don't have to do it. Mm. I mean, you can almost make it like a Pinot Noir if you wanted to. I mean, the laws dictate that you make it in a certain way. But the smart guys are managing within the fabric of the law to make wines that are less reliant on this strongly tannic structure and much more able to accentuate the very interesting fruit characters of Nebbiolo that actually you never got before because it was beaten out of them by the way the wine was made.
So if the producers are adapting their winemaking and modernising, is it time for us to ask consumers to adapt and modernise their drinking, encourage them to approach these wines sooner?
Well, because of the job I do, my palate is very attuned to drinking young wines. And I enjoy drinking young wines because I find it's then that their individuality is easier to diagnose. You can see the fruit elements more easily. You can get a much clearer sense of terroir and even the individuality of the winemaker. The more you age the wine, the more these kind of influences become blurred. These wines then metamorphose into these wonderful, soft, overwhelmingly kind of sensual experiences. But I don't get the individuality of expression so much in old wines as I do from young. I also, just almost an aside here, but if you keep a wine for a very long time, your expectation of that wine's ability to absolutely blow your mind when you finally do open it, you expect it to be the best thing you've ever tasted.
Yes.
But it's just an old wine.
Yeah.
And very often it can sort of disappoint. Delicious, but not the earth-stopping moments that you thought this very ancient bottle of really good Bordeaux should be. What you're doing, you're drinking history, you're drinking a moment in time,
yeah.
And then you commune with that moment rather than expecting to overload your senses. If it is that kind of sensory energy that you're wanting to enjoy, then drink them a bit younger. And the advantage of the modern genre of warmer vintage wines is that they are accessible earlier, a little earlier. I'm not suggesting that you should drink these wines within a couple of years, but whereas in the past you might have waited 25, I think you've probably got a decent window of sort of 15 to 20.
Yes, and I think to add to that, with drinking windows in the past, I still see customers looking at a drinking window and seeing it as a bit of a goal almost to get to the end of that drinking window. If it says drink between 2025 and 2050, that's often seen as encouragement to leave it to 2050.
Yes,
and actually, those are the extreme boundaries within which you are likely to enjoy this wine. If you prefer your wines a little fruitier with, you know, a bit more of that vibrancy, then drink them younger. Drink it in 2025 or 2030. And actually at 2050, whilst it will be as Mark says, a beautiful taste of history, you may well have lost a little bit of the complexity and a little bit of the vibrancy that it had when it was younger. Understanding it's really a spectrum and not a single end point you're getting to.
A spectrum, I think, is absolutely the right word. And as a business, we're very aware of this. It is the question that customers ask us the most. Yeah. When should I drink my wine?
You mentioned drought earlier. Tell us a little bit about how that influences the style of a wine. We're expecting to see more drought within these classic fine wine regions in coming years. So what impact is that likely to have, both in the vineyard and in the bottle?
So if you have a very dry year, the vine is a growing plant like anything else. And if it doesn't have enough water, it has to take some kind of evasive action. And given that we're expecting the vine to be producing grapes for us to pick and make wine from, in fact, in the end, if there's not enough water, the vine will say, well, I've just got to survive. I won't put any more energy into making grapes. I'll drop some leaves, I'll stop the transpiration. And the vines just shut down. And what a vigneron will say, the vines are blocked and nothing happens. So if you do get an extreme period of drought, then basically you don't get ripe grapes. You get little pellets of thick-skinned berries with not much juice in them and not very ripe tannins either. So you get very darkly coloured, strongly tannic, rather awkward wines and not much volume out of it either, because when you press the grapes, there's no juice in them.
So it's possible to have a pot vintage with very little water and end up with wines that almost feel underripe.
Yes, that's a paradox, isn't it? That would be the case. But that said, we talked about the definition of what great terroir is about, and great terroirs also allow the vine access to water, even in the most extreme circumstances, because the vine has a very, very deep taproot. And in effect, it's much more to do with how you manage the vineyard than it is weather conditions that allow the vine to regulate itself during these challenging times. And it's certainly been my experience that in the past, I credit a gentleman called Stephen Cronk for this quote. He's a member of the Regenerative Viticulture Foundation. He's a grape grower and producer in Provence. And when he first moved down there, he was told that anyone who grows grapes down here, they just think of the soil as something to keep the vine upright. And then you just pick the grapes. All the great wine addresses now realize the total importance of soil health and biodiversity. So everybody's working as hard as they can now to reintroduce life back into the vineyard. How or if you fertilize, how or if you plow, how you generate all the elements that used to be in the soil but aren't there anymore. And if you create this individual kind of biome for your vine in which it's able to gain everything that it needs, bizarrely or even miraculously, it will self-adapt. In the old days, you would actually intervene to try and help the vine through the difficult times. Nowadays, actually, you do less and less to the vine, and you prune less, you leave more leaf on the vine to protect the bunches from stop them being burnt. You just allow the vine to find its way through the challenges. And if it's growing, A, healthily, it will have a properly developed root system. And if you're growing on good terroir, you will have access to enough water just to keep the thing ticking over. It doesn't need to be, you know, in a bath. If you're on gravel, it's got to have a deep tap root so it can get down to the water table. If you're on clay, the clay will be holding that water for you and the little filamental roots will be digging it out. So a combination of properly informed and sustainable and, if possible, regenerative viticulture, but arm in arm with an understanding of when to intervene and when to not intervene, means that the wines that are being made now are able to survive and will come out the other end with balance inside them. And there are all sorts of remarkable kind of side effects of this. There's a Burgundy address that we go to every year, and he's been biodynamic now for over 20 years. All the fertilizers by animal manure, very minimal intervention in the vineyard. The wines, even the hottest vintages, are singing with freshness. And they are usually a whole degree of alcohol less than anything that's been farmed a little more proactively. Water is a problem, and there will be more marginal areas where water will become an issue. We do talk about the future of the classic regions. What's Bordeaux going to look like in 25 years if temperature continues to rise? That I cannot forecast, but I suspect the lesser terroirs, well, I know the lesser terroirs will struggle more than the greater terroirs.
Good soil and good terroir, absolutely key. Mm-hmm. So on that note, you have brought, we were talking about Burgundy a lot, you've brought along for us a wonderful bottle. So we've gone for the 2020 vintage by Thibaut Ligier-Belair. Mm. Tell us a little bit about why you've chosen this bottle, Le Grand Chaillot.
Well, I chose it because it's a hot vintage. I just wanted to have a look at it and see whether anything that I've been saying is actually justified by what's in the bottle. But I brought it because I also wanted to show something not at the top end. This is a very good Bourgogne Rouge, but a Bourgogne Rouge nevertheless. And from someone who does embrace all the ideas and techniques and philosophies and more that we've been talking about over the last few minutes. What this wine should be able to do is demonstrate both the richness of the vintage, but also the freshness that's been retained in the wine because of the principles that Thibaut embraces.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Wow, there's a beautiful colour there.
So this is a wine from Thibaut Ligier-Belair, who's a very good producer in Louis Saint-Georges. Yeah, and he has vineyards in Louis Saint-Georges, in Vaux-Romanée and Chambon and Beaune, and also some up in the Haute Côte as well. I think he's the single largest owner of Les Saint-Georges, the best vineyard of Louis Saint-Georges. But this wine, though, is made from vines that are in the Louis Saint-Georges commune, but they're not classified as Louis Saint-Georges, but they lie just outside. And he also adds in a little bit of fruit that he farms from a producer in Chambon-Musigny. So it's two-thirds Louis Saint-Georges, one-third Chambon-Musigny.
But of course, can't be labelled like that. And so it is, as you say, a simple Bourgogne Rouge. And that category can hide, it can hide an awful lot of sins, but also an awful lot of gems.
Absolutely.
One of those where choosing the producer is really, really crucial.
I've just looked up my tasting note from when I tasted it in barrel in 2021.
Wonderful.
20% whole bunch. So that's when you use some whole bunches of grapes in addition to the ones that you've destemmed. And whole bunch is a way of adding more perfume into the wine, also giving a slightly lower acidity as well, and a bit of freshness. First note is squid ink deep. It's a really dark colour for a Pinot Noir. But then the nose is vibrant and very pure with a lovely creamy length. And this is grown on clay. So we were talking about water retention earlier on. So that the richer clay here is going to be very water retentive. And so the natural way that Thibaut makes his wines, I'm not saying this is a natural wine, but he's non-interventionist. He is biodynamic. His whole winery is sustainable. He has those amazing solar panels in his front yard, which is shaped like a massive daisy.
Yeah, like a sunflower. It follows the sun during the day, doesn't it?
He's so attuned into all this. And then the winemaking, as I say, will be just very intuitive, very gentle. He will have used plenty of extraction because he wants to get the flavour out of this wine.
But so that's where you're sort of pummeling the grape skins, basically, to get the colour and to get the tannins.
He would have just pumped it over. He wouldn't have been as aggressive as punching them. But what we're really looking for here is a wine that doesn't smell of the heat of sunshine.
No, not at all.
And if it did, it would have something edging towards slightly pruny, something a little thick and heavy, even jammy as well. It can smell of raspberries and it can smell of strawberries, but it shouldn't smell of strawberry and raspberry jam.
Yeah.
Because it's got to have the freshness in there to give the wine the vitality and the lift of aroma. And I think this is such a good example in the sense of what is modern Burgundy about, because it is very pure, and exactly as my note said, very vibrant and very pure. But it has much more texture, much more of a rounded, smoother, creamy texture than Burgundy of a generation ago. But it still retains all the hallmarks for which we love Burgundy, which is its purity of fruit and that sense of finesse, of intensity without heaviness or power. that we look for.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, a real freshness to the fruit. It's perfectly ripe. There's nothing here that feels in any way underripe. But as you say, there's none of that jamminess. There's no sort of baked fruit character or dried fruit character. There's a real, you know, sort of like crunchiness to the fruit.
Absolutely. Crunchy. And this is a wine from a really hot vintage. As I quoted earlier on, this is the year of days at a time over 40 degrees.
And this is not a Grand Cru or a Premier Cru.
This is from a decent but fairly ordinary terroir. So even at this simpler level in these more challenging vintages, Burgundy and Bordeaux and other great regions, that they can all do it. But you have to be so attuned to what it is you need to do and what you don't need to do.
Yeah.
Because almost without any doubt, Thibaut would have done some work in the vineyard here to shade the grapes from the sunshine, because in full exposure, they're going to burn. And then you get all these hot flavours that we talked about earlier on. So managing the fruit in the vineyard and being so sensitive to its requirements once you get it in the cellar, it's a lot more work, but you can still make really, really great wines, even in these hot, challenging vintages.
And how do you see this wine evolving in bottle over the next 5, 7, 8 years?
Well, as for a wine at this level, the expectation is actually you wouldn't necessarily have an expectation of it really needing a lot of time. But I've got to say, I think that wine seems to me to still be on the upward curve of its maturation graph. And I don't think it's probably at peak yet. I think there's probably a little more to come out of that. It's delicious to drink now.
It is.
And absolutely, with these kind of wines, they need to be the sort of experience that means that you want to have another sip and that it draws you back. And the way the aromas are unfurling, I can see you going back in and in again, Barbara, and getting more and more aromas out of it. For a wine of this level, I think it has a level of complexity. There's no sense of shortfall of intensity of the palate. Anyway, it coats the palate completely. It's not a donut, you say. No hole in the middle of the palate. And the finish is not complex, but it's long and correct and has absolutely perfect integrity and just leaves with that little bite of freshness and almost salinity.
Yes, a little bite that makes you want to go back and have another sip.
Absolutely, yeah.
Beautifully put together. I think this is a really beautiful illustration for anyone who does sort of think, well, actually, you know, heat equals high alcohol and jam. This says 13.5% on the label. Of course, there's perhaps a little bit of wiggle room with what's on the label. But it
might be. But bear in mind, he's used a whole bunch, so that will have brought the alcohol down a bit.
Yeah.
It's also on a cooler bit of land
because
it's not a great terroir. It's on the wrong side of the Route Nationale. And it's from clay as well. So all these little bits of the jigsaw come together to create something that, I think it has its own personality. And I think it shows the character of the grape variety and the producer far more than it does the character of the vintage. And in fact, I would know it's come from a ripe vintage. I don't think I would say it comes from a hot vintage.
Fascinating. For those customers who are looking to buy, let's say, very classic styles of wine, for wines with high acidity, really savoury flavours. Mm. Are there parts of the world that they can still look to, or is it about looking for specific producers?
Yes, I mean, in the first instance, we touched on earlier on, if you plant your vineyards higher in the hills, you're going to retain more acidity in your wine. But equally, just in the Northern Hemisphere, look further north. Just go towards cooler climes. The wines of the Loire Valley are having a great renaissance at the moment, because that's a region that was kind of, for red wines in particular, probably just a notch the wrong side of marginality. And you would often get little green capsicum notes coming through those wines more often than not. Nowadays, the Cabernet Franc there gets beautifully ripe, but they're still really fresh and crunchy. So, yeah. And who knows, England may be the place to look in the future as well.
Indeed. Well, we'll start with sparkling, but we'll see where we go from there. So tell us, Mark, which bottle in your cellar from a warmer vintage are you most looking forward to uncorking in the future?
I just came back from the Southern Rhone about a month ago, looking at the 22 vintage. And that's a region that has always been hot and it's getting hotter. But I have to say that the 22s there are almost, the good examples are almost Pinot-like in the way they're they're starting to understand how to make Grenache work in those environments. And indeed, so talking to Vincent Avril at Clos de Pape, he's saying we don't need new grape varieties in the south of France. We've already got a grape varieties that are properly adapted to hot weather. So there's no need to plant Tarigo Nacional or anything. Grenache will do the job just fine, thank you. But to that end, Vincent always opens up a few bottles when we do. And I took the opportunity of seeing a few bottles of his white Chateauneuf de Pape in our Basingstoke shop a couple of years ago, and I've tucked those away in the corner at home. And old white Chateauneuf de Pape, especially from Clos de Pape and Vincent Avril, is one of the wonders of the wine world. And so that's that may well be coming out at Christmas.
Note to self. Thank you for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to browse the producers mentioned in today's podcast, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or if you're interested in starting your own fine wine collection with Berry Brothers and Rudd, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again for listening. I'm off to hunt down some old Clos de Pape Blanc. Cheers!